For October 5th, 2017, it's the Lullabot Podcast. It's the Lullabot Podcast, episode 218. I'm Matt Cleave, a senior developer at Lullabot. With me, as always, co-host of the show, senior front-end developer, Mike Herschel. Hey, Mike.
Hey, how are you doing?
Super. How are you, Mike?
I am fantastic. I'm excited.
I am, too. You know, a couple of episodes ago, we actually touched on this topic, but we're going to come back again. We're going to bring it around.
It's an important topic, right?
Yeah, we're going to be back on the train talking web accessibility, since we're going to, you know, spend all this time with the front-end, with the back-end, working on these websites. We need to make sure they're usable for everybody, right?
Absolutely. And this week, we have a super awesome guest.
We have a senior front-end engineer at DQ Systems. I'm told she's a rehabilitated Flash developer, creator of the well-known Accessibility Wins blog. She won an O'Reilly Web Platform Award for her work on accessibility. She works remotely from Bellingham, Washington, which is outside of Seattle, I'm told almost Canada. Hi, it's Marcy Sutton. Hello.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, and we also have one of Lullabot's resident accessibility experts.
An accessibot.
An accessibot. front-end developer here at Lullabot, speaks about accessibility and related topics around the Drupal sphere, enthusiast of dinosaurs and dinosaur paraphernalia from tropical and muggy Orlando, Florida. Welcome, Helena McCabe.
Thank you very much. Hi,
Welcome.
Guys.
Welcome back. It seems like we just talked to you.
I know. You can't get rid of me.
I know. One of these days.
Helena, maybe you could just explain for a second. You know, you're the one who jumped back and was excited about this topic and decided to say, hey, Matt and Mike, we need to do this again.
Well, yeah. I mean, as my Twitter profile boasts, I never shut up about web accessibility. So if I ever have an opportunity to, you know, move that ball forward and get people talking about it, I think it's good to keep it in the conversation as much as we can.
Marcy, if you don't mind just kind of introducing yourself and how you kind of fell into the web accessibility world and how that works today.
Yeah, so I work on accessibility full-time on tools for developers to try and help make accessibility easier to achieve. But when I started, I worked at an agency. I didn't know anything about accessibility. I remember being like, headings, lists, what are those? And it turns out that's a pretty common path for a lot of developers, is you kind of just stumble into it. Maybe you didn't learn about HTML markup as much as you should have. And then all of a sudden I had to do client work for Target, and they had legal action brought against them at one point that it basically meant that anytime as an agency partner, you created a web experience for them, it had to be accessible. So it was actually a really great series of events that led me to getting to know accessibility. And once I learned about it and I met people with disabilities, it was such a game changer. And now I can't turn that part of my brain off. So pretty happy with the way it turned out.
That's a good part of your brain to turn on.
Yeah.
So how is the state of accessibility on the web, and how has it changed since, you know, you began your accessibility journey?
Well, the tools are definitely better. I remember learning about ARIA, and it just seemed like there was kind of this hidden layer in terms of what was exposed to screen readers that I just didn't understand. And there wasn't a lot of visibility to go debug that kind of stuff. And since then, now there's, you know, inspectors like the Chrome, the developer tools. They have an experiment for debugging accessibility that I like a lot. The Edge browser has a pretty cool tool as well, and I work on tools, so I think that part's definitely more modern. The education and awareness part is what I'm constantly hammering away at, trying to get more people into the conversation, get more people up to speed, even just knowing that it's something they need to do. I think a lot of people kind of fall into sites without learning about accessibility, so I think it's a bit of a struggle there at times, but I try to stay optimistic and just, you know, open one person's eyes at a time to the amazingness of accessibility.
Yeah, exactly. I kind of followed along a similar trajectory, although obviously not quite as far into accessibility. When I, you know, I'm mostly self-taught, and so when I started, of course, you're listening, you're learning about headings and lists, and you just don't think about screen readers and tabbing around and that type of stuff. And it, honestly, it was a lot of Helena's work. Helena and I worked on sci-fi, the sci-fi.com together, and some of her work there that like really kind of opened my eyes to that, which is pretty cool.
Aww. Yeah, I mean, I think awareness of the issue and attention to it are really steadily increasing, and that is really, really encouraging. The problem is it still isn't uniformly making it all the way through the development process from dev awareness to end user. It seems like there's like a lot of cracks for it to slip through from there. But I do see a lot of improvement because years ago, you know, I'd be like, oh, I'm speaking about web accessibility. And people would be like, oh, what's that? And now people are like, oh, cool. I love accessibility. And It's nice seeing it catch on.
And honestly, if you don't love accessibility, like what type of monster are you? Right?
Exactly.
Exactly.
Well, oftentimes the argument you hear against it is budget. And another thing might be sacrifices you might have to make in your design. So what would you say to designers who say that accessibility requires sacrifices be made to their wonderful, perfect designs?
I would say embrace inclusive design, like learn how to make it so that it can work for more than one group of people. Because it really does start with UX and design. Like, I think it would be a total misjudgment of skills to leave that behind, because it can be so beautiful if it's really baked in from the start. I mean, you think about even just like in a physical space, trying to add a wheelchair ramp when it wasn't designed into the building's architecture. So similarly, on the digital side, it really, you can make something that's more inclusive and sort of holistic if you're considering it all the way at the beginning. So I try to empower designers to recognize how powerful that is and how you can make something that works for all different kinds of people. I think the caveat to that sometimes is that they have to let go a little bit. Like you aren't going to get pixel perfection across every single browser on every single device. And I think if you're embracing responsive design and mobile, it might be a little easier to imagine, I don't know, somebody navigating your site by voice or using a screen reader, or really just recognizing that you can't control exactly what the end user is going to experience. So I think there's a lot of opportunity there for design. I would like to see more of it for sure. Because it's a shame as a developer when you kind of get set up to fail and sure, we can try and fix this, but it's really the problem originated in the design.
Okay, my ignorance is showing. You mentioned navigating by voice. That's a thing? How does that work?
Yes. If you were using something like Dragon Naturally Speaking, which is a sort of an assistive technology in that you can use voice commands to navigate the web. And it really depends on well-structured markup and text labels that are not, I don't know, text on the screen that you can identify and then use as a command to get it to navigate somewhere. For example, like if you had just a plain anchor link and it said, click here, and then the screen reader text off screen was like, to read more about this specific article, that would be kind of hard to use from a dictation standpoint because you wouldn't get that missing context of which link you were trying to get to. So that's a pretty big topic that I just walked right into. But I think my point was really that there's other inputs that we have to consider. Voice is the sort of the next big frontier, I think, that I'd like to see more of. And it's really making interfaces that can work in multiple ways. Have you experienced that at all, Helena? I'm curious to hear your take on the voice interfaces.
Voice, not so much. I haven't worked with. I know I've spoken to people who use a mouth stick, and you know they were like, please, you know, don't make me click 9,000 times with a mouth stick to get where I'm going. You know, the more clicks, the better for me. So that's kind of what I've heard as far as feedback goes.
Yeah, totally. That's another type of an interface. Like if you're in a wheelchair, yeah, and you have like one stick that you use with your mouth, or maybe it's something called a sip and puff where you're, I don't know, using what's available to you with your body to actually navigate the web. And I'd really love to see more companies do user testing with people who are navigating in other ways, because it's so, it's almost shocking to see someone use your website in a completely different way than you imagined.
Definitely. I mean, as able-bodied people, we can test as best we can for accessibility. But even if I spend my entire life educating myself on accessibility, I will never be able to browse as a blind person would. I'm not blind. There's a level of skill involved in actually living in that body that you can't really get to as a sighted person, or, you know, as a person with full use of their limbs or fingers or what have you.
I think this is kind of demonstrating just very quickly here already how broad this topic actually is. So we've talked, mm-hmm. you know, several different ways already, and I'm sure we're just kind of scratching the surface.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think, I mean, what I try to do, there's so much possibility, and my mind opens up and I kind of start rambling about all the possibilities, but that sort of forgets that there's these basics that get left behind. Things like form controls needing to be labeled, and icon buttons missing text for screen readers, and keyboard support. So I really try to start with the basics that people are often forgetting so that we don't get overwhelmed. Because that's really what I want to see on the broader web, is people getting those basics right. And then we can start moving on to these more advanced concepts. But often that's left behind. So that's been my approach lately, has been try and get, like, bring people along to just get started and get those things going, and don't make them feel bad that they didn't do it before now.
What's on your hot list of basics? I know that a lot of people have been trained for alt text now, but that's just the beginning.
Yeah, alt text is good. If it's decorative, you can sort of leave the alt attribute blank. My number one testing tool is the keyboard, because often you'll see demo sites and code pens and things where they've made something interactive, but it only works with a pointer device like a mouse. And if you're using a keyboard to navigate, that would not be usable to you at all. So I usually recommend, as the first thing you do, try and navigate your web pages without a mouse or a trackpad and see if you can reach everything and operate everything. And then
Mike, remember me doing that to you?
Yeah.
Yes. You can do it. Good. I think that should be like number one requirement to make sure that something is active.
I was thinking, and this is just me kind of off the cuff here, it would be so cool to have like some type of conference like booth where we take kind of, you know, front-end developers and we give them, all right, well, here's a screen reader, but we're going to put, you know, a pillowcase over the screen, and now get this information and just see how they work with it. Or, you know, give them a web page and say, hey, this is it, but we only have a keyboard here. There's no mouse. And just to kind of get those gears turning, I think something like that would be pretty neat, but maybe a little bit of work too.
I think Facebook had a thing like that. I'm looking it up right now. It's called the Empathy Lab.
Ooh.
Where they, I don't remember if it was, yeah, it's in their main engineering building, and I think it had multiple purposes, but something like that where you could have experts there available. I don't know. I think there's many permutations of how you could do this, but I love this idea.
I think Helen and I are going to do this at Florida Drupal Camp. I'm calling it now. Florida Drupal Camp 2018.
I'm totally on board. And we don't need a pillowcase. A lot of the time to check for low vision users, what I do is I just turn the contrast on my screen all the way down, or the brightness.
Ooh.
I just hit that button until the screen's black, and then I see what I can do.
Which, conveniently, I have a life hack for you related to this. When I fly on airplanes, and for some reason, if I need to type in my credit card information, I will use a screen reader and turn my screen all the way down, and then no one can see over my shoulder.
Mm.
Nice.
Life hack.
Clever.
Yes, nice. Do not get your credit card stolen on an airplane like I did.
Did that happen?
It did happen. Yeah, that was a real pain.
Now that's going to be the last time that ever happened.
Yes, I've learned my lesson.
Let's kind of switch the subject a little bit to kind of modern frameworks like React, Angular, Ember, and just these super heavy JavaScript sites where they're just writing everything out in just one big bundle. Is that can that be accessible? Can it work well with screen readers? And are there any like tips and tricks to that?
I think Mike's also assuming that it's also something that can cause lots of problems too, right?
Yeah. Are there any big gotchas, right?
Well, the first question, yes, they can be accessible. I think a lot of times the gotchas are just based on the framework that you're using, might not have the best documentation for accessibility, or if you're reaching for a component framework and that doesn't have good accessibility. But it's totally possible to make a single page app accessible. So some of the things you would want to consider are the keyboard support thing I mentioned, so that if you are using some components that keyboard users and screen reader users can navigate them. Focus management is really big. So in a client rendered application, like an Angular app or a React app, you want to navigate the user's focus around so that they're never just kind of left hanging. Like, take, for example, if you had a sortable list and you could delete an item out of the list by going onto a button, maybe like a little X delete button, and then it removes that item from the DOM. If you didn't handle the user's focus, maybe to send it to the first item in the list or some other element, they would just be dropped and it wouldn't be handled gracefully. So focus management, especially if you have new views appearing like in modal dialogues or layers, we want to make sure we're handling the user's focus in a way that they'll be in the right area of the application to start navigating, and that they know that there's new content on the screen.
Are there any libraries out there that help out with that? Or is that something that needs to be done by the developer manually?
For focus management, it's really hard to write a library that would handle that, just because it's so hard. There's so many ways to build an app that there's no one-size-fits-all solution for that. But I usually try to advocate for a test-driven approach so that you have test coverage for these things that's in your app, so you can make sure that, you know, say you work really hard on your modal dialogue to make sure focus is sent into it when it opens. You'd want to capture that in a software test so that your teammate wouldn't unknowingly break it. So that's what I try to recommend for stuff like that is, build it into your actual application and get test coverage on it. So that's one way to approach that. I did ask Ryan Florence, who's pretty prominent in the React world at one point, if he had written anything for that. And his answer was pretty much the same. Like, I don't know what, a developer would be trying to script for focus ahead of time. So it's sort of hard to write a tool for that. But it's helpful to look for like accessible patterns that handle it. And I know I can send you some links for the show notes, but there's a couple of good examples that we can look to for inspiration.
There's actually a gotcha in Drupal with that, that usually we have to fix in the sites that we build. When you have a view of content and then there's that load more button that Ajaxes in the next chunk of content, the focus will actually just start over at the top of the page if you don't manually set it after that fires.
Do you know who is a maintainer of that module, that views load more module?
I do not.
Matt Oliveira, who is one of our coworkers, so I think you should hit in Slack.
Aha, I will ping him.
That would be a good one to fix because Helena, you probably know, but for anyone else who wouldn't know in that scenario, your focus would be sent back up to the top, and then you'd have to navigate through all the content you already read.
Yes.
To get back to where you were, which would be a super huge pain. Like, nobody would want to use your site if that was the case.
That sounds exactly. Like there could be a core bug with Drupal's Ajax system. That's tricky. I haven't seen it work well on us. So.
I mean, all it does is it basically just reaches out to, like, the endpoint, takes in all of, you know, the HTML that's underneath that, the one DOM element, and just kind of writes it directly into the DOM. It's not terribly complicated. You know, I think if there was some JavaScript to kind of just remember what that last, I don't know, DOM element was and reset the focus there, something like that would be probably pretty straightforward.
Awesome. We'll volunteer to fix it.
The snippet. Well, I posted posted the snippet for the fix on Drupal.org, replying to someone's question when they mentioned the same problem. So the code's floating around there somewhere.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, I guess we're kind of getting on the side right here.
Rabbit hole. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
No, it's interesting. I'm super geeking out on like, ooh, what's happening there? Like, is the whole page being re-rendered and it's like dropping focus? Or I wrote a focus manager at one point that because the page was being re-rendered, we could look for an identical element and then send, like, if that was the last thing that was focused, then send focus right back to that identical element. But if the element changed, we needed some hook to know where to send focus back in. And so we used a data attribute to be like, oh, this is the element that was supposed to be focused next time. And I can dig up an example of what that looked like, but it is nice to build up a utility like that to reuse from project that, I don't know, it, depending on what framework you're using, there isn't one like solution for all frameworks, but something to be aware of for sure. Focus management.
Mm-hmm.
Well, speaking of testing that you had mentioned, do you know of, like, any good accessibility linters?
Yes. There's one for JSX using ESLint. It's by a guy from Twitter. I'm blanking on his name right now, but I think it's called ESLint JSX A11Y plugin or something like that. And that is a nice tool because it will warn you in your development environment if you've forgotten a form label or something like that. The caveat with linters is that they are only, it's like static checking in your IDE that may or may not have styles applied or JavaScript applied. So it's nice to catch some like really low hanging fruit things. But like the tools I work on, we really aim for the page being rendered and all the CSS applied because that can change it quite a bit. And then you may have thought you fixed something, but it's like, their label's going to display none, or I mean, there's so many scenarios that we test the page like after it's fully rendered.
That makes sense.
So you gave a talk at this year's FluentConf on accessibility with continuous integration. And when I looked at your GitHub repo, you had, I forget the name of it, but you had like some type of tool that you were using to do this. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Well, so the big tool that I work on is a JavaScript library called AxCore. And that is it's a set of accessibility rules that we maintain and the engine that powers, we use it in browser extensions and WebDriver APIs and things. But there's a CLI called AxCLI. And I think I may have showed that for CI, but the thing with accessibility testing in CI is it's just going to run whatever your test suite is. So you could build that however you want.
Yeah.
It could be, you could have unit tests that it runs or a whole suite of unit and integration tests, which I usually advocate having a mix. For something like focus management, that can be easier to do in an integration test, whereas you might have some component that you want some like quick unit tests to, you know, make sure it's functioning correctly, and especially important for UI frameworks where you have lots of configuration options and you want to make sure, you know, if the user supplies text for a label that it ends up in the right place and all that kind of stuff. So CI, the big catch is like you just need some accessibility tests and then it'll run them automatically, which is pretty cool. But I think the tool you were wondering about is probably AxCLI.
Yeah, that's what I was looking at.
So what that does is it's a command line tool where you install it globally with npm install -g axcli, and that's axe-cli. And then you can supply it one or multiple URLs to hit, and it will go out, hit that site, run the accessibility rules in AxCore, and then return you a set of results in JSON. And you can either save those results and pipe them into another system, or I think the free tool is intended to be sort of a developer convenience tool where you can just have it go and give you some results and try and fix them. So it really depends on what your workflow is like, what tool is going to be the best fit. But having a consistent set of accessibility rules across your whole team can really make it so you're all solving the same problems and not like, oh, this person uses this accessibility tool and this person uses this other one, and we're like not meeting in the middle.
Mm-hmm. So besides tests, do you have any favorite accessibility tools? I know you mentioned some Chrome Developer Tools stuff. I know that there's a new accessibility audit in the audits pane of Chrome Developer Tools. I've heard of, was it Pally Dashboard? Anything else that you want to talk about or that's awesome?
Yeah, I mean, that's what's so great and different than when I got started is that there are so many tools. I'm pretty partial to AxeCore because I work on it now. But I mean, mm-hmm. even before that, like I went to work on it because I used it every day. It's like, oh, mm-hmm. this is cool. And so the Chrome extension, I think, is probably, I mean, beyond like my first pass would always be test with the keyboard. My second pass would be use the AxeChrome extension. Because it'll float up really, you know, low-hanging fruit to you, like you forgot a label or you're using ARIA wrong or something that's like really error-prone because we're human. That can be really useful. The Chrome audit thing that you mentioned actually uses AxeCore. So the rule set that they're using in the Chrome, it's actually run by Lighthouse.
Mm-hmm.
Lighthouse is using AxeCore. And I think we're seeing a lot of adoption by big companies who like the stability of our rules. And I'd say I like Pally's dashboard. I'd like to see us add something like that. I think we've got a more solid rule set, which depending on like if you're working on a big team and I don't know, so for a lot of companies, the actual rules that they run are really important. And so that's why we've put more of a focus on that. Let's see, what else are good tools? We have
wave
some
tool.
Yeah, the Wave tool is awesome. I know there's so much brain power that's gone into tools like this. Like even like Axe, I think, is the third generation of it at our company, and the folks at WebAIM have written theirs. There's another tool called Tenon. And so it's cool that like some of these techniques have been tested out and we're sort of landing on the ones that are the most reliable. There's also an effort in the W3C to standardize some of this stuff. So we're not just reinventing the wheel over and over again. Those groups are the Ottawa CAG group and the Accessibility Conformance Testing Task Force, I think. So that's pretty cool to see. So we're all kind of like solving the same problems, so we might as well standardize them.
Yeah.
And it's not just tools for devs either. For instance, Color Oracle is a really cool tool for designers. And I believe there's a sketch plugin as well. But so you can see what your design looks like with different types of color blindness and make sure that, you know, everything's going to show up and it's not going to end up looking really weird if someone's red, green color blind or something like that.
Yes, that would be great.
Really cool.
We're talking web accessibility. Marcy Sutton's laying down some knowledge along with Helena McCabe on the Lullabot podcast. Right after this, we're going to get in and talk a little bit more about what developers can do to make sure they're doing the best possible job as far as accessibility is concerned. Also, we wanted to talk about how accessibility works within some content management systems and open source. Coming up right after this.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, it's Lullabot senior developer and host of the Behind the Screens podcast, Chris Albrecht.
Hey, you know, Mike Herschel pinged me the other day and he said, hey, Matt, you know who should do the mid-podcast promo this week? He said, we should bring Chris on. He can talk about Behind the Screens.
Wow. Hey, what a great idea. I have a podcast too.
I said, just like last time, right? And he said, really? We did that last time? Yeah, we did, but we want to hear about it. So, Chris, you've got a few episodes out. Behind the Screens is kind of coming into its own.
Yeah, it's really starting to evolve into more than I thought it was going to at first. I'm enjoying doing these interviews, and I've learned a lot about the people I've interviewed so far. So I'm just trying to figure out how to keep them short enough now. There's so many fun questions to ask.
So how long do you actually want these podcasts to be?
So the original goal was to try and keep them sort of within the realm of what the original podcast was, which was like 5 to 6 minutes. I thought I'd make them a little bit longer, maybe get up to 10. But lately, it's been hard to trim them down to that short of a time. So I've been going about 12 to 15 minutes for each one, which I think is still, it's still pretty good. You're getting into the what's going on in the community with the people and getting into the people themselves a little bit. But it's still quick enough you can get to it on your commute or just pop it in when you're making breakfast and it doesn't absorb a lot of your time or you have to pause it and start it again later.
So the Behind the Screens podcast, you can find it anywhere great podcasts are found.
Yes, lullabot.com. iTunes, FeedBurner, Stitcher, all of those things.
Anything more you want to say about it, Chris?
I will be at Bad Gamp doing interviews live, so they won't be produced live. They'll be recorded and then put out later, but I will talk to you live in person at Bad Gamp if you've got something cool to say. I'm also looking for people who are putting on camps and conferences if you would like to say something about the trainings or sessions or how you organized your camp or conference.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Matt.
Hey, welcome back. We're talking web accessibility with Marcy Sutton. We're talking a little bit of everything with web accessibility.
And that's weird, Mike, because we're usually talking Drupal things, aren't we?
Yeah. Yeah, we are usually talking Drupal, but...
This is one of those topics that kind of goes beyond just, you know, Drupal, though, right? It's kind of a web development thing in general.
You know, I saw this tweet on your timeline, Marcy, and it said, accessibility is a civil right. And I thought that was, like, really cool. I might be kind of paraphrasing that right there. But
no, that's exactly it.
From my point of view, like, access to the internet, like, that is my personal livelihood. If I didn't have internet here, I would not be making money. And to deny people that livelihood based on... you know, your lack of accessible websites seems like a real problem. So it's really cool to be here talking about it.
Mike, I'm glad you touched on that, because it's not just the civil right of people being able to use websites. But like you said, you know, we have our career on being developers, and there are a lot of developers who, you know, are visually impaired or blind or have various disabilities as well. So we're not just looking at this from the angle of the end user, but accessibility in the tools that we use to do our jobs so that people with disabilities can also do the same jobs we do.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not just developers. There's more and more people that do remote work as all of us do. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about different content management systems and accessibility. You know, Drupal puts a lot of work into our accessibility, but do you have any experience with anything else and maybe how Drupal compares and how it stacks up and maybe if there's anywhere where it's lacking?
I think Drupal and WordPress are the two content management systems that really stand out in my mind as putting a lot of effort into accessibility. Mm-hmm. And I think I hold them both in very high regard just based on how much effort they have put in, and how much community outreach there is as well. So making strides in an open source project, like as large as those are, it has to happen, but it's really nice to see. I don't think there's any other content management systems that even like are on my radar as being accessible at all, which is a shame. But that's kind of the way it is. So I would like to see more of those. I mean, it would be nice to have more choice, when you are trying to choose a CMS, but being able to like solve problems in the core of a system like Drupal is such a great way to fix something once and then have it trickle down to every consumer of that CMS. So I think Drupal and WordPress are both doing a really good job.
Yeah, I remember when Drupal 7 was first released. This was 2011, and I saw the skip link, and I didn't know what that was. I was like, yeah, I saw this in the template. I was like, what is this skip link? You know, and of course I Googled it, and it was just the fact that it was there kind of opened my eyes a little bit, which was pretty neat.
Wait, you didn't just delete it?
Well,
we don't need this stuff. Get rid of it. No,
this is weird blue outline on stuff. Get rid of that.
Yeah, I've heard all of this before, and we laugh, but that is a thing. People will be like, "Oh, I don't know what this is for," and I've seen it time and time again where a developer mm-hmm. won't understand the purpose behind that, and so they do just delete it, or you'll add a. We were going to talk about CSS resets, and this is a big sort of hot button mm-hmm. topic about focus styles, because historically CSS resets would remove the focus style for every yep. interactive element, and that's a problem. Mm-hmm. It's hard to, you can't reset that once it, I mean, no pun intended, but like once it's been reset, you can't reset it again. Yeah, this kind of all comes together where we're using these tools, you know, be it a CMS or even just a pre-made CSS reset file. And if, you know, you're just trying to get your job done and you don't understand what everything is doing, you're sort of set up to fail. So that's where it's nice to have tools that float up these problems to you to make it easy to identify that there is an accessibility issue. And on the CMS side, I know there was in the CK editor, I believe, there was like an accessibility checker for content people, which would be really nice because you might not be technical at all, but if you're writing content in a CMS that, you know, could be university content or, I mean, just social media content or marketing stuff, whatever, and you might be just pumping infographics in there and having like no clue that you need alt text and stuff. So having tools like, you know, a checker in your WYSIWYG editor would be so nice because it makes it a lot easier for people to get it right.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you.
Absolutely.
So more of those. If there's a plugin that you can add to your WYSIWYG editor for content owners to utilize, install it and then show them how to use it.
Because content editors do tend to have a harder time, I think, because a lot of content editors are not developers. So they're one step removed away from like what's happening on the code, what's happening with screen readers. So it is really important when you pass a site off, you know, as an agency to leave the content editors with that knowledge before you go away.
Totally. Yeah. And you can't expect someone to go view source and go craft the HTML. Like I do that without thinking. And I remember being in a client meeting where we were trying to win an account we were trying to win a project where we were going to be building a CMS for this client. And the sort of internal client that we were up against was like, oh yeah, you'll just like write HTML. And like the people who were going to be hiring us were like, we aren't developers. And we ended up winning the project because we were going to give them structured data where they could just type raw text and then we would, you know, populate it in the correct markup and everything. And I remember that being such a deal breaker for them that their own team just didn't get it. They were like, nah, you just learn HTML. We're like, no. That's such an unrealistic expectation for a content writer.
I remember there was this one website a long time ago, and I don't even know why this is coming to mind, but they had like some beginning HTML tag. Like it might have been like a large tag or something like that back when that was a thing. And they never ended it. And so they would put this at the beginning of every single paragraph tag or something like that. And by the time you scroll down the website, and it became a thing, you know. On the internet.
I remember. It was like a sewing or quilting website or something.
And you would scroll down and like the T would be like larger than your monitor and stuff like that.
Oh, boo.
Yeah, it was like nested open H1 tags or something.
Something like that. Sound ridiculous. Yeah.
I remember that. Yeah, that got fixed. I was really sad. I tried to go find it as an example to teach people about HTML and they'd fixed it. I was really sad.
Yeah, maybe we can recreate it sometime.
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely a disconnect. Depending on what sort of experience you're making, where you might need to set your CMS up so that, you know, content writers will be set up for success and they aren't expected to learn HTML. That's kind of the beauty of a CMS. We don't always have that option depending on the platform that we're building for, but that is one nice thing about actually customizing a CSS. And I know that's easier with some CMSs than others.
Definitely. Yeah. Even just like conceptual knowledge is important to leave them with as well. Because even if you give them a WYSIWYG with just buttons for heading types, if you don't educate them on, okay, well, you need to use these in order and you need to use these appropriately, what you'll find is that people start using heading types decoratively. Yeah. So it's really important to at least try to get them to absorb a quick foundational knowledge of like, here's the basics of what these do and why it's important not to use these like crayons.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of checklists. I know sometimes those don't go far enough, but often, I mean, even when I'm like deploying software, I will go and look at a checklist. Okay, let me make sure I didn't forget anything. And having a set of steps tailored to your task, be it writing content, you know, publishing an NPM module or just coding an interface. Like if you had something you could refer to, I find that those really help me to make sure I didn't forget anything. So for a content
person, that's a really
good idea. That would be a really helpful deliverable to give somebody like, hey, here's a quick accessible content primer that you can refer to when you publish stuff.
I wonder, like, you know, there's, I mean, we're working with computers, you know, if we write some type of module or some type of plugin that when they hit the save button, it does like almost like a continuous integration check on the actual content, and it passes or fails. And depending on that various different rules, it might go to someone else who then has the ability to kind of override it and approve it or something. I don't know. I'm just kind of thinking.
Yeah, definitely, you know, options.
Yeah, I think you're on a good track there. Maybe have a small like electrical current where if you submit something that isn't accessible, it just zaps you in your chair.
I think that's a genius idea.
Well, when you mentioned a checklist, something I thought of, and basic knowledge of HTML, something I thought of was forms. And a lot of times forms end up not being very accessible. What can someone do to make sure that they do a good job with their HTML forms?
Well, fortunately, that's a pretty easy one to automate. So in a lot of accessibility tools like Axe, and pretty much all, I'm sure Wave has some stuff for this as well, you can just run a checker to make sure that you didn't forget a form label. I mean, ideally, you can get to a point where you just remember those. But the important thing about forms is that if you don't label something, a screen reader user might have no idea what a particular control is for, and they might be opting into spam email without realizing it, which is pretty not horrible. Cool. Yeah, super
uncool. Not great.
I mean, anytime you're collecting user input, I can't believe how often this gets forgotten, because, I mean, it's like, who are we building stuff for? And this is, I guess it's why it's so frustrating, but it's also an opportunity at the same time, is because these are pretty easy parts to get right. So just label things, like make sure that every control it's exposing what that thing is for. Like, are you collecting your first name or your middle name or your email? Like, make sure that's connected to the form control. And if you're not sure how that should work, you can use an automated tool, and if you got it wrong, it'll tell you, like, oh, you need to go fix it on this element, and here's some suggestions on how to do it. So that's why in our tools we try to give you remediation steps, like ways to fix it, and then links to go learn more about it. Forms are – that's such a foundational thing if you're building user interfaces.
And having a label is good. I mean, it's definitely great to point that out because that's step one. But it's also important to remember to be specific with your labels. Like, I've been told from users, you know, that can't see, that one of the biggest things we do wrong with labels is when it's a form element for a number, like a phone number or a social security number. Sometimes it'll be like three boxes, like one for area code, or, you know, one for the first three digits, then the next two digits, then the last four digits, or, you know, an area code box and then the rest of the number. So if they're split up or if they're all together, it's really good to specify that in your label so that people can tell, like, oh, am I putting three numbers in here or seven, or what am I doing here?
But that doesn't look pretty.
Well, yeah. Tough.
No, seriously, that doesn't look pretty. I mean, my designer told me I can't do that. Is there a way to make that available to people who would be using a screen reader or other technology and not be seen on...
Well, yeah, you can hide that span by clipping it. So then the screen reader will hear it, but no one will see it.
Is that the right thing to do?
You can. It starts getting into where you're changing it for different users, and it's harder to maintain. I would really try to just get one field for a number, because especially if it's international, the format of the number might be different. Just do one field and make it easier on everyone. I guess another thing that you might want to consider is if there is a format that someone needs to follow, you could make that part of a placeholder or some sort of description text maybe you've got an input field and the label is phone number, and then maybe you've got an ARIA described by attribute pointed to a paragraph or a span or something that has the format in it. So then when a screen reader user, they land on this field, they hear phone number, and then they hear the format. It's like it exposes both of those pieces of data to them so they can successfully type in the right formatted number. And also it helps just as a user in general to be a bit more forgiving about your format. Like sometimes, you know, you go all the way through a form and like they're just being really picky about the format. Like, you have to use dots instead of hyphens, or
yep.
you can't use hyphens. There's so many combinations that are like pretty easy to get around with JavaScript. So just make it easier on your users.
Definitely.
Yeah, you can handle all that stuff server side.
Client side and server side.
And client side, yeah.
What
absolutely.
About custom form elements? Something like a color picker, or you know, whatever somebody imagined.
Oh, yes. That can be challenging. I guess the first thing is if you're going to make, well, first you should see if there's a native element first. Yeah. There isn't really a color picker. Definitely not cross-platform. I know a date picker, that like the input type of date, that one's been really slow to make its way into browsers. But if you are going to make something custom, make sure you can operate it from the keyboard and a screen reader. The colors definitely need to, I guess, like label the color somehow so that someone who's colorblind can be like, oh, this is the color. But for something like that, that's sort of a new frontier. I would definitely want to get it in front of real users and test it as soon as possible. Because it's really easy to get something. Yeah, that's a particularly challenging component to build because, I mean, if you're just using like an entire color wheel, it's like how do you operate that with a keyboard? Is it like every single pixel is an arrow like key move, or
there's an input? I mean, we're kind of getting off right here, but there's a color, like input type color that supported in Chrome, and I'm looking at Can I Use right now, and it supported on everything except for IE and Safari. And iOS Safari and stuff like that. So, I mean, like obviously, like native controls. Yeah, I'll shoot it over to you. It's obviously that's something cool. That's not used too much, but it's pretty neat.
It is used sometimes. Yeah, and I guess what's nice. So this is the native input type. It will use what's available on the operating system, and then the accessibility of that really depends on the operating system. Apple does a pretty good job of making things accessible. I know Windows does as well. So like if you can use the native thing first, do, because you will avoid a huge can of worms of things that you didn't think about. I know we are going to build a color picker into Axe, but it has a limited number of colors. So that's a little bit easier to make a custom thing because you only have to choose from so many colors. So yeah, that one's pretty challenging. I think a date picker is a little more common, but also pretty challenging.
Yeah.
So you definitely, I think there's multiple ways you can design those. So there's no one right answer, but definitely get it in front of real users tested. Better to learn that it doesn't work sooner than later.
So let's talk about mobile devices, accessibility on mobile devices. How do screen readers work on, say, like an iPad, iPhone, or Android device? Are there any type of ways for people that might not have, you know, motor skills to navigate around that type of stuff?
Yes, absolutely. So if you have an Android phone or an iPhone or an iPad, you already have a screen reader that you could test with. On iOS and OS X, it's called VoiceOver. On Android, they have a screen reader called TalkBack. And they work in similar ways in that when you turn the screen reader on, you have like a mobile tab order, basically. So you can swipe left, swipe right, and it'll take you through every focusable thing on a page, sort of like a keyboard. And there's other ways of navigating. So on iOS, you have what's called a rotor, and you could navigate by headings, by form controls. It's really similar to a desktop screen reader. It's just the mechanics of how you get into these things is slightly different. But it can be totally freeing for someone to be able to use this device. You know, say you're a blind person out using Google Maps or whatever, and it's like telling you where to go. So it can be really freeing for someone to have this technology in their pocket. And for someone with limited mobility, they can use a switch device, which is essentially like a pared down keyboard with just a handful of keys. And then they can navigate using switch access, which is really cool. I guess for supporting that, you want to have structured markup. You want to group things so that if you're the way that a switch access interface works, I guess there's a couple different ways that or a couple different modes. But the general idea is that you have a scanning mode where it'll like scan the screen, and then whenever the visual scanner goes over an item that you want to get to, you tap, and then you kind of like go more and more drill down into the element to select it. And so for something like, this is what Helena was alluding to earlier, that you want to limit the number of clicks it takes someone to complete a task. So often it's about simplifying your interfaces and your user flows so that there's just less steps to do things. I'd say the biggest thing on mobile is to make the touch targets big enough that human hands can operate them.
That's one of my personal pet peeves right there.
These buttons just keep getting smaller and smaller, and
people with disabilities that give them low motor skills or, you know, not super fine motor skills, to be able to hit that, you know, even if you've got a tremor or something like that is important.
Yeah, it's impossible. So yeah, I'd say the biggest thing, I mean, for everyone would be to use bigger touch targets. Yeah. I mean, at least if you're using a mobile screen reader, you can kind of like swipe through everything that's focusable on the mobile site. And so you have a sort of an easier affordance to get from item to item. Because yeah, if you're just trying to navigate by touch, it can be really difficult.
Do you have a rule of thumb? How big is big enough?
I've heard 48 by 48 as a pixel dimension. I think that's sort of a generally agreed upon guideline. I think it depends on the resolution. I've heard 24 by 24, so it's somewhere in there. But it's not just, I don't know, it's really the space around things, like giving them more padding. Just yesterday I was on a desktop site and there was like a big blue button, but it wasn't a button, it was a link, and it didn't have padding in it. So it like looked like a button, but the like actionable part was just the text in the middle of it. I'm like, why does it have this button style?
That's so weird.
Similarly, on a mobile device, you want to actually make the, you know, give it padding so that you can hit it anywhere in the bounding box.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's the funny thing. You know, you ask, is mobile accessible? But as far as like the people with disabilities that I've spoken with, a lot of them prefer mobile to a desktop computer because it's actually more accessible for them.
Generally, yeah, it's simpler. I mean, streamlined interface, there's just less things on a page, so it's harder to get distracted. Mm. On native stuff, there's frameworks, especially in iOS, that make it a lot easier to get it right. Sometimes the APIs are just, they're not changing as rapidly as web technologies. And I know some of the test or some of the accessibility APIs are frequently used in testing. So I do think that in native mobile, there's just less variables. It's like pretty much you need to label things. So that's like the biggest need. On the web, you know, we can do whatever we want. Talk about being a recovering Flash developer. I remember interfaces just being so all over the place. And we can do that again now with JavaScript. So
I know. Another one of my pet peeves is when I see loaders on websites now, and I think to myself, what is this, 2005? Come on.
Get it together.
Creating preloaders that were Flash. That was like the first code I ever wrote. It was great.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That wasn't copied for an Apple IIe, you know, from a magazine to make a program. I mean, I don't think that really counts. But so as a recovering Flash developer, I mean, I'm thinking about Flash and accessibility, at least in the early days, and it was the screen reader read, you need to install Flash.
Yeah, it was horrible. I remember I looked it up multiple times, and ironically, I did work at Adobe for a little while. But there was this claim floating around out there that you could make Flash accessible, but nobody was able to do it because it's just one big image.
Yep.
I think maybe if that technology had stayed around, those APIs would have been improved on. But I don't think anyone was able to be successful with that. So yeah, I'm pretty glad that we're more solid on web technologies, because we have sort of as much as it does feel like the Wild Wild West, I think we have stable interfaces to use with HTML. And I think for JavaScript developers, really understanding that foundation is important.
Yeah, absolutely.
And being nice to your users. I mean, with JavaScript, it's, to quote Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. Because, you know, if you're changing, you know, the DOM order around, you need to make sure that it's actually going to still read in the right order and you're not just shoving things around.
How does Flexbox work when I change the order of stuff? Does the screen reader still read it in the source order, or does it read it in the order that I specify within, like, the, you know, the CSS order property?
I think it depends on the browser.
That's great.
Firefox, yeah. There's some people who have done research on this, but I believe that Firefox does the right thing, but other browsers don't. Okay. And so there's some discussion about trying to make it more consistent.
What is the right thing?
I would expect, if you reorder it, for the new order to be announced, so that you don't have this mismatch between the way it looked, you know, at that one viewpoint or breakpoint, and then, you know, you like change everything around, and the screen reader is still I don't know if the order of the DOM is still like I don't know. I can see
the user should experience the information in the same order, no matter how they're perceiving it.
Well, that's an interesting topic. how can if I'm interested in accessibility and I want to really get in there, where do I go to learn about this? How can I? Who do I follow on Twitter? How can I? I don't know. Just educate myself on this.
And on top of that, Marcy, like, how do you keep up to date? Because things are changing.
I get a lot of, it's difficult sometimes, but I get a lot of information from Twitter. I do have to sort through what's going on in the world, which can be a little sad. But there's so many experts that are sharing what they know, especially on Twitter, that I think that's a great resource. If you go to the hashtag A11Y, which is a numeronym for accessibility, there's often people celebrating wins or just talking about new tools and things. Most helpful thing I could recommend beyond that would be the Web Accessibility Slack channel, which was funded by Slack, and I can send you a link to that. But that what's nice about that group is no matter what time zone you're in, there are experts there, like, super stoked to answer accessibility questions at all hours, and it's such a great resource. So that's a great thing to do. I have a course on egghead.io that has some, like, development videos on how to make accessible user interfaces. Mm-hmm. And there's also a longer course on Udacity from some of my friends at Google. If you're wanting to do, like, a longer free accessibility course, theirs is really awesome.
Awesome. We'll put links to those for those in our show notes.
Yeah. Nice. Oh, I guess one more would be a site that we have at work called DQ University. And that has, like, a bunch of training and free stuff. And it's free to people with disabilities. Our paid content is free. So that's pretty cool.
Oh, that's super cool.
So yeah, if you know someone with a disability, they can go get free training on accessibility.
Nice. Yeah, and if you want more of the human element instead of just straight tech, on Twitter, AxeChat happens pretty frequently, and that is definitely worth tuning into. It's, you know, people with disabilities and people in the disability community chatting about, you know, what's frustrating, what's not, and what some solutions are. So,
you said that was AxeChat. Can you spell that out?
Yeah, AxeChate.
I think it's Access, AXS.
Oh, you know what? You might be right.
I only know because I participated once, and I see it every week. Like, they do talk about, you know, things they're really passionate about, and sometimes it's really good to hear it from the people who need it. Like, we kind of get off in our, you know, altruistic, like, feel-good, happy time, and it's not a happy time for people with disabilities in the real world. So it's sort of good to ground yourself in the real problems that people have to gain some of that empathy, and I find that really energizes me to solve things in ways that people can actually use them. Like, it's not about me feeling good about this. It's about making it more usable to someone with a disability.
All right. I'm going to ask the silly question. Is that like a live Twitter? Like, how does that work? I'm not familiar with that.
The access chat.
Yeah.
It's a hashtag, right? It is a hashtag. It's a, weekly chat, I think, on Tuesday afternoons, I guess, depending on what time and what time zone you're in. But it's some folks from the UK that have this weekly chat about accessibility.
And it's like an open conversation. There'll be like, you know, 5 to 10 different topics, and they'll say like, okay, topic one, and ask a question, and then people weigh in using that hashtag and the number.
Yep.
I gotcha. I thought maybe Twitter had invented some sort of other interface that I was not familiar with for like live communication, real time type things. So
no, it's kind of like there's other groups that do similar things, like the dev.to folks do it, and the Code Newbie podcast does it, where they'll see like question one, just like Helena said, that where you can go and answer and go look back on what other people are talking about. There's usually kind of like one overarching topic and guest every week. But it's sort of, it's a great resource on the Twitterverse.
That's funny though, that I nerd quirked that. Like all these years I've read it as Axe Chat. Axe S.
Yeah. Axe Chat would be my team.
That's funny.
Access Chat.
All right. Well, is there anything else that you want to mention before we wrap up, Marcy?
I don't think so. I guess just thanks for taking the time to talk about accessibility. I think, you know, every little bit that we contribute to it helps. And
absolutely.
Yeah, it's a learning experience for me every day too, and that's what I like about it. So go forth with accessibility.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you, Helena, for coming on and sharing your knowledge.
Oh, I'm always around. Whenever you want me, I'm here.
And sometimes when we don't.
Mm-hmm. Often when you don't. Yes. Here I am in the peer reviews.
Awesome. Well, thanks for listening. You can get in touch with us by tweeting at Lullabot. Go ahead and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you find us. That's how people can find us, if you rate us and let other people know how you enjoyed us.